accession number 21547, Real 1.
This is an interview with Ken Shepherd, formerly of the Fleet Air Arm, recorded by Rodney Giesler on June the 20th, 2001, for the Imperial War Museum Sound Archive. Ken Shepherd, Reel 1. Right, Ken, let's start at the beginning. When were you born?
May the 16th, 1924.
And where?
In the village, Farfield, where he still lives.
In Farfield?
Yeah.
And what did your father do?
He was self-employed. He took over a building business from his father in partnership with his brother. Well, they came back from the First World War and they took over the building business that his father started in 1885.
Really?
And they ran that business together until 1946-47 when I came home from the forces. I went into partnership with Dad and I stayed with them until 1965. And I packed up then and went to work for a builder's merchant in Gloucester.
And you went to school locally, did you?
Yes, I went to the local, primary school as they call it nowadays, up at Tortworth. Used to walk a mile and a half to school and a mile and a half back at night. And then I took a scholarship exam and finished up at Thornbury Grammar.
Thornbury Grammar School.
Mm.
And what did you aim to do with yourself? Go into your father's business?
No, I wanted to go into the Navy, right from this height. But I couldn't get in because I'm colourblind. And they wouldn't take me. I tried as a boy, and because I failed the colour test, they wouldn't take me.
You're completely colourblind, are you?
Hopeless.
Really? So you just see everything in grey?
Oh, no, I see colours, but yeah. I just cannot recognise them.
Really?
Anything that is a very primary colour, like bright red, bright blue, I can tell those yellow, but orange, yellow, and some reds all get mixed up, browns and greens get mixed up, pink and grey get mixed up. Wonderful world I live in.
Oh dear, yeah.
But I've never known it any different, so I don't find it any handicap.
So how long were you at Thornbury Grammar then?
Well, for 5 years. And I left and I worked at the post office for a few years until I was 18. And when I was 18, I was silly, I went to volunteer for the Navy again and they took me. The best day's work I ever done because I thoroughly enjoyed my service.
Now you told me before we started talking you remember the bombing on Bristol. Were you living
in
Bristol?
No, I was living out here watching it from here.
Yeah,
15 miles away.
Yeah.
That was all I ever saw.
Yeah.
Bristol and Bath getting bombed in the distance, but I was a member of the ARP services out here, first as a messenger and then as a first aider. And then, as I say, I went into the Navy as soon as I was 18.
So that would have been 1943?
42.
42,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm.
And where did they send you?
Royal Arthur at Skegness for a month, and then up to Scotia, which was Doonfoot near Ayr, now the Butlins Holiday Camp. And that was where I did my training as a radio operator.
Can you tell me a bit about that training? How did you start?
It was very concentrated because it was normally a 3-year training for the regulars. We did it in 6 months. And they just pumped Morse into us and procedure, and you just had to do it very, very intensively. And at the end of 6 months, you took your exams and bingo, you were then an ordinary telegraphist.
Mm. And so you got up to what sort of speed reading Morse?
Well, 22 we had to, because we had to pass out, from memory, at 20s.
That's 20 words a minute.
20 words a minute, yeah. And then I took a rate for WT3 lower when I was on board ruler and finished up as a leading telegraphist, and we had to read at 22 then.
That's five letter groups,
yeah.
Is it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And any groups, they're not necessarily words.
Oh, no. It could be code groups, but it could be figures. But when we went out to the Pacific and working with the American fleet, we had to read it up to 32 words a minute then. Because
52?
30.
Oh, 32.
32.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they had automatic transmitters. And the Admiralty made a great big faux pas. They sent us to a girls' secretarial college in Sydney to learn touch typing. Not very successfully, as you well imagine. But, I mean, I was able to use a typewriter, two-finger sort of thing, but I was able to read at 30 words a minute then. If you concentrate, you can do it. But you can't read it for any length of time, not writing. And until we got adept enough with a typewriter to take at those sort of speeds, we had a couple of American servicemen that would double bank and read messages that directly concerned our group or our ship. But they were only with us for a few weeks until we got up to forward areas, and they left us, and we coped with that from then
How
on.
How did they read it then?
With the touch typing.
The touch typing,
yeah.
Again.
Yeah.
And in your training, did you have to tune your own transmitters?
No. No, we were operators, pure and simple, because by that time they had a radio mechanics branch, and everything that was, you know, technical with the sets was done by the radio mechs. That was one of the reasons why I couldn't get in as a youngster, because that would have been part of the training. And with colour vision, defective colour vision, with coloured wires, I shouldn't have been much good, should I?
And resistors, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, when you were qualified, you came down from Scotland.
Yeah, I came to Scotland. I went back to the Devonport Barracks and sent us out to the signal school at Glen Holt. And I was there for, I suppose, a week, 10 days. And I got drafted then to Londonderry, the shore deputy station in Londonderry. And I've been there a few days, and I went to the sports ground, and they found I had a little bit of ability with a cricket bat. So I stayed in Londonderry on the shore station till the end of the cricket season. Came back and went into barracks in Devonport and out to signal school again. And a short time, and then we picked up a draft to CVE 50, which was HMS Ruler.
Now, on your training, and in fact when you were in Londonderry, the sort of traffic you were passing, it was all coded and meaningless to you, I suppose.
Yeah, basically. We were working with the escort groups that were on the western approaches and coming in and out of Derry. But it was, as you say, it was coded. But we were able to do our own decoding, because coding and decoding came into our training. We could have qualified as a coder. We also had to learn the procedure for assembling messages and that sort of thing.
And so you knew what the traffic was about then?
Not really, not unless we sat down with the code books and decoded it.
Yeah, but when you were trained to do it.
Oh yeah, we were able to decode messages then, yeah.
Now the coding system was just in books, it wasn't using sophisticated things like the Enigma machine or anything,
not,
was it?
We did have I think they called them codecs on board the Ruler when they fitted us up with machines, but until then it was all done from books. Mm-hmm. But I found that fascinating, coding and decoding, but I was a lot more interested in reading more.
Did you find decode and discover interesting signals or not?
Not particularly. No. Because anything that concerned the group was, or the ship itself was, when we were on board ship, was done by the, we had a sub-lieutenant in charge of coding, and he supervised that with a petty officer coder. Obviously for secrecy reasons. But there weren't too many rumours getting around the ship.
Yeah. So you were, at this stage, an ordinary sparker, a telegraphist.
I was in charge of a watch. I was a leading telegraphist in charge of a watch.
Oh, you were a leading telegraphist at that time,
I passed that in Greenock. When we embarked our squadron in Belfast, we went back across to Greenock. Well, I went to Greenock with three or four more others, took our exams, and then rejoined the ship in Greenock.
You joined Ruler in Greenock, did you?
No, I joined Ruler in Vancouver.
What ship did you join in Greenock then?
No, the Ruler came back from Belfast to Greenock,
and I
rejoined Ruler then.
I see.
The little bit from Belfast to Greenock was the only bit of Ruler's commission that I wasn't aboard on. Because I joined her in Vancouver with the advance party.
Yeah.
And I went back to America with her with the ferry party when we took her back. Went back to Norfolk, Virginia, and paid off over there.
So following on, you were in barracks at Devonport, weren't you?
Mm-hmm.
And you then went out to Vancouver, didn't you?
Yeah, when we picked up the draft for CVE-15, we went up to Liverpool and went across on the Pasteur, an ex-French luxury liner, went into New York, into Asbury Park in New Jersey, and we were in a hotel. The Barclay and the Monterey were the two hotels that we stayed in. And then eventually we picked up a train and we went across to Vancouver. It took us 5 days and nights on the train from New York to Vancouver.
How did you feel when you arrived in New York after blackout and rationing?
Completely and utterly lost, especially coming from the country where we were blacked out long after the war. We had no street lights there. But completely and utterly lost. But it didn't take you long to adjust.
You enjoyed the food you couldn't get hold of here.
That's right, very much. Yeah.
Now, the train across Canada, I mean, that was...
That was a wonderful experience.
Yeah.
In the book that Ted's got there, there's one of the fellows made a diary of it, and he's put a complete description of that. And it's wonderful to read it again. It brings so much more to mind that obviously we'd forgotten. But you had enough foresight to do that.
Yes, quite. How did the Americans and Canadians receive you?
No complaints. We got on all right with them. I preferred Canada to America. Mm. But America seemed to me to be too much of a rush. But Canada was a bit more like ourselves. A little bit easy going, a bit slower. But no complaints. We had some good times with them.
And I suppose you had a lovely journey through the Rockies, didn't you?
Oh, wonderful. Yeah. And we went across to Seattle and then up to Vancouver from Seattle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then we came back down from Vancouver, down the Pacific Coast, through Panama, up to Norfolk. I think it was three trips we did, ferrying aircraft,
mm-hmm.
back to Liverpool and Greenock, and then back to the States again, Norfolk, New York.
So you came down the Pacific Coast and through the Panama?
Yeah.
And was that quite an experience?
Oh, Panama. Well, it was a terrific experience.
Yeah. So you went up to Norfolk.
Yeah.
And you were really a cargo boat then, were you?
Well, we were travelling as a merchant ship, basically. Yeah. We had our own personnel on board, but
yeah.
I mean, we were just, the flight deck and the hangar deck were just packed with aircraft.
What aircraft were you bringing over?
All sorts. Barracudas, there was Hellcats, Avengers, Corsairs, a whole lot. But according to the book, we carried more aircraft in one go than any other escort carrier did in ferry, and we got up to 80 on one trip. That's something we didn't know until we read the book.
Mm.
But 80 aircraft on board. It's
it wasn't a very big ship, was it?
No, only about 15,000 tons.
Mm.
But been a very valuable cargo had there been any trouble, but fortunately we didn't get any.
You travelled alone, did you?
No, in convoy.
No, in convoy.
In convoy, yeah. Went across, I mean, well, we were travelling in the faster convoys. I mean, our convoy's 8, 10 knots, we were 12, 15 knots sort of thing. But
Do you remember any attacks while you were in those convoys?
There was a US escort got tin fish on the way back, but we were closed up for about a quarter of an hour at the ready. We didn't even go to action stations as far as I remember, but that's the only time we had any problems coming to or from.
Yeah.
And then we picked up the squadron in the Clyde and did some flying trials. And
which squadron was this?
885.
Mm-hmm. And what were the aircraft involved?
Hellcats, Corsairs and Avengers. Oh, that was the three that we carried.
Three American types.
Yeah. And we left UK originally to head to the East Indies fleet. But on our way out, the sailing orders were altered and we were diverted to Sydney to join the Pacific fleet. And then we joined the fleet train that was attached to the Pacific fleet, which was a few store ships, tankers and that sort of thing.
Can you describe me a bit more about what the fleet train did?
Very boring. Steam around in circles, a few hundred miles away from the fleet. They steamed around in circles. We did exercises and our pilots were flying patrols at the time. And there was another The speaker, I think, was the other one with the fleet train. She was with the fleet train more for replacement aircraft and pilots for the fleet when they came back, had they lost any damaged or anyone lost. They would come back and they would refuel, and once they were back, our aircraft would do the necessary patrols to give the fleet pilots a rest. And while they were, there were tankers there, they were refueling, restocking what they wanted from store ships and this sort of thing. And then they disappear for about a fortnight or 3 weeks and then rejoin us again.
So you never actually sailed with the main Pacific Fleet?
Nope.
No.
No. We did have a spell of 57 days without seeing land.
Mm.
And that was, we finished up then in Yokohama Bay at the signing of the surrender.
Mm. Did you see any Japanese aircraft or ships?
Nope. 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 Only you might have seen a few ships while you were tied up in the harbour, but we saw no Japanese aircraft. We had no problems at all out there.
Mm.
Only overcoming the boredom.
Yeah, presumably, I mean, you in the WT office would be privy to all the comings and goings and the demands of fresh aircraft and fuel or
well,
whatever.
Not really, because all that would have been coded, you see, and we didn't decode anything.
Oh, I see, yeah.
I mean, we would take messages, and we knew some messages had come in for the group or for the ship or for the fleet train. Task Force 112, I think that was. But and then one period, we did go down to truck when the Implacable, I think, the Implacable had just come out to the Pacific, and it was an exercise for her to raid truck. And we stood offshore about 3 miles and acted as spare deck. And anything that got damaged didn't crash on the Implac. They kept her flight deck free for operations, and they come and crashed on board us. We saved what we could and then ditched the rest over the side. if it was serviceable and could be repaired, it would be repaired and take off and rejoin her.
So that actually happened then, didn't
mm-hmm.
it? Yeah.
There's one or two came and crashed on board, but nothing serious.
Did all hands have to turn to and push the aircraft over, or was it?
That was the job of the flight deck party.
Yeah.
I think some of the stokers, they were in charge of the barrier wars and that sort of thing, but as far as we were concerned, we were ship's company, and the squadron was a completely separate entity. They had their own, you know, their own squadron members that joined us as a member of 885, and they did their own engineering and that sort of thing, and electrical work. And we were ship's company, just taking them where they wanted to go, and they just did their own work on board.
Mm.
We were basically a floating hotel, movable hotel sort of thing, hotel and workshops for them.
What were conditions like on board? Were pretty cramped? Or?
You asked Ted, because he served on the W Gold V and W class destroyer. I never did. That was the only ship I served on. But from what I've seen of RN ships, they were absolutely palatial. We had
what, the RN ships?
No, this is the one we were on. And we had canteen messing, we had a laundry on board, we had tier of bunks and plenty of room in our mess decks.
Why was that?
Well, it was American. It was basically an American-built ship, the USS St. Joseph. And they built the hull, and they put a flight deck on the top, and then they fitted it out to Admiralty instructions in Vancouver. And but, I mean, the Americans, they would never have accepted the conditions that our boys had to in the the corvettes, the destroyers and that sort of thing, that had been built up over the years.
Yeah. Was it air-conditioned?
No, not air-conditioned, no. But we certainly couldn't grumble. We had plenty of food, plenty of room. We had two big canteen flats that, we used to eat in. In fact, one of the canteen flats, I believe, was used because we brought a crowd of ex-POWs out of Japan that were released, their own people that had been released. And they messed down in the after canteen flat.
Did you see much of them?
Oh yeah, they integrated. In fact, a fellow in Thornbury showed Ted where he lived when we came back this afternoon.
Really?
Still see him regularly. He was captured in Burma.
Did they talk of their experiences to you much?
Not a lot. This fellow, I knew him before he went in the Air Force, because he worked in the building surveyor's office, and I was working with Dad at that time before I went in the Navy, and I knew him before he went in. I left a local paper. We were asked to leave any local papers, you know, in this place where they were, and put our name and mess number on, and they could come and contact us. And John came along and found me. But they were all suffering from beriberi and that sort of thing. But
they must have been in an awful state.
Well, they weren't very clear, but they were the first lot that were strong enough to stand the sea journey from Japan down to Australia. The speaker left the day before us, but they brought hospital cases down as far as Manila, and they were flown down from Manila. But ours went down the whole way on the ship, by sea.
And they were from camps in Japan itself?
Yeah. They'd been released, you know, by the forces that were then ashore by then.
Do you remember any particular stories they told you about their time in captivity?
Not really. It was something they didn't talk very much about. I see John in Thornbury very often nowadays. But he did contract TB, but he's clear of that. Now, he went to American hospital. When I came home, I went across to Iron Acton, his mother lived, and told her that I'd seen him, and he was in a fairly good condition and was able to reassure her of that.
Anyhow, you ended up in Tokyo Bay.
Yeah.
Were you near the Missouri?
Not far away, but we could see her just...
Did you actually see the peace signing ceremony in the distance?
No. That was Dawd and under, you know, below decks.
Yeah.
But we didn't... We were there for...
And did you come straight home after the
yeah,
did the prisoners ferrying come in after that?
We left them in Sydney.
Yeah.
And then
that was after the peace declaration.
Yeah. We sailed a couple of days after that, and we came down to Sydney, and then we came straight home from Sydney through the Med again, called in at Malta, and then back up to Greenock. And that was in the end of 45. And then the beginning of 46, I went back to America with the ship, and we took a few hundred American servicemen back for demob. And then we paid off in Norfolk, in Virginia, and up to New York by train. And then we came home on the LST depot ship called the Fife Ness. And a few of our officers walked off and wouldn't come home on it. They came home on the QE. They were ordered to return, but they were cashiered, lost everything.
Why wouldn't they come?
Because they were going into a part on the ship that was marked Native Quarters.
What? Native Quarters?
That's what it said. I mean, it was built as a merchant ship,
yeah.
But it had been adapted as a LST depot ship. It had never been used as a merchant ship, but the part that was had Native Quarters over, and they were a bit cramped, and they refused to sail there.
And they got cashiered for it?
The ones that walked off the ship, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, one of them was a warrant gunner with youngster and youngster service. That was the end of the ruler saga, really.
And how long were you in the Navy after that?
I came out in May. After I came back from... the States last time, I went back into barracks, and I went down to Pembroke Dock then, and went down with the petty officer to Leckerbis that was aboard us, and we closed down the radio station that was at Pembroke Dock, and then back to barracks for a few weeks, and then got demobbed.
And then you came out and joined your father's business?
Yeah, I went into dad's business then, yeah.
Yeah,
as I say, I stayed there till 65, and then I closed it down, because We had Barclay Power Station there, an old power station down here, and there were no youngsters taking up any apprenticeships. And I could see that we should be struggling, so I got out while we could.
Couldn't get the skilled labour?
No. I mean, we had fellows that had been on apprentice to my father just after the First World War. In 1919, 1920, 24, 25, they were apprenticed then. Well, they were coming to the end of their working life. No youngsters taking the trade.
They were all going down to the pastures.
That's right, yeah. So I went to work for builders merchants, and there I stayed until I retired. But the practical knowledge I got in those intervening years made my life very, very easy.
Right, in the building trade.
In the building trade, yeah. Because I had practical experience, both from working at the tools and from quoting managerial side of it. And I go to work at the merchants, and all sorts of people work at builders merchants, whether they know anything or not. I shouldn't be any good there now, because they're not interested in computers.
No, no. Everything's on computers.
Yeah, everything. Yeah.
What about, you have children of your own?
Just the one daughter.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Well, I think this is a very good story. Is there anything else you can think of? Or?
Not really. I don't think so. That basically is what happened to me during the Navy.
Fine.
And I got no complaints. I had a good time. I was lucky. Mm. A pleasure cruise, basically.
Yeah.
Mm. No troubles. You know, we did a refit down at Newport over the way. We were down there for 3 months. I came home for 30-odd days leave.
Newport, Isle of Wight?
No, Newport,
Newport,
Monmouth, just over the way.
Yeah.
And I had a bicycle aboard ship and was home every night.
Oh, well. No, it's a different world, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ken, thank you very much for talking to me.
Okay, well, thank you very much.